Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm Chris Cosentino, chef of Coxcomb here in San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. This program is of our Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. So, I can read all this, and trust me, there's a lot of it. But I'd like to introduce Marcus Samuelson, owner of Red Rooster in Harlem. Marcus and I have known each other for 15, 20 years.
Something like that, yeah. Four Olympics.
Yes, yes. None of which we've competed, maybe what he might have cooked in.
Yeah.
But it's an honor to have him here in San Francisco. I'm really excited about the new book. Has everybody got a chance to take a look?
Nice.
This is one of many. This is number four?
This is the book.
This is the book.
Yes, it is.
I have all. I have the original Aquavit.
Yeah.
I've been pretty much to every event that Marcus has done in the city, and I'm really excited to talk about Red Rooster because I was fortunate enough to be there when you opened.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for one of the opening events, and it's an absolutely beautiful restaurant.
It's fun.
And it's the most fun I've had at an opening.
Yeah.
I mean, you had it rocking downstairs with your music venue.
Mm-hmm.
And dinner up. I mean, it was like three different music levels going. Outside music, inside music, downstairs music, right?
Yeah.
Did I miss a beat there? Do you have music in the kitchen?
We do have music in the kitchen, but not during service.
Okay, good.
Because then the musicians, you know, takes over for the supper club. So, but right now, at this very moment, actually, Winter Marsalis is in our basement playing. So there will always be music.
Not bad digs.
Right? Not bad
not
at
bad.
All. No.
You know, not no. Some like penny ante kid from down.
But music
the
has always been a big part of your life too.
Yes, very much so.
Music. Why do you think chefs and musicians, and there's an energy, there's a similarity there, right?
I think, you know, music and food are very harmonious.
Yeah.
They go well together. One sets the tone, the other sets the tone, and then together they become very powerful.
I felt that when we started the restaurant with Red Rooster, when I started to think about the idea of Red Rooster in Harlem, I had to go to the musicians first, actually, because they had done such a great job of explaining Harlem and the vibe of Harlem. I felt like more people knew about sort of music and the energy of Harlem, what that sounded like. You know, people like James Baldwin, Maya Angelou have done a great job sort of explaining what that could read like. And Apollo, you know, again about music, and so people like Jacob Lawrence and so on. It really was of the movement of what that could look like, what could basically the migration look like, but what it would taste like in the present time.
That's on you.
Yeah. No, well, there's a lot of people before, but I felt like in the present time to be, that was still something that you can, there was an opening there and do something that was inspired by the migration, but it also felt very much in the present.
So can you explain a little bit of what drew you to Harlem? You know, I've read the book.
Yeah.
I've gone through it, you know, and you and I have had this conversation.
Yeah.
But I don't think everybody here is privy to what brought you to Harlem. I mean, it's such a magic street you're on.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's many things. I think that both Chris and I came up in a time where we're lucky that to be young enough, but also old enough, in a time where you come up where cooking was one way. You came up through a French chef, or if it was an American chef, he put on a French accent, and it screamed like the French chef, right? And this idea about music in the kitchen was absolutely no-no. And there was one way, it was one narrative to become a chef. And I came up at that time, and my goal was to be in a 3-star Michelin restaurant. I worked in a 3-star Michelin restaurant. And eventually, getting my own stars. But you realize there's something else. And that pivot, you've done that in your career. The only way you can do that is to really look into, okay, what do you crave as a chef? Because if you're not, as a creative person, keep filling that pantry with good stuff, your food gets stale. And we're afraid of that as chef. And for me, it was, and from the outside looking in, I was extremely successful. I was a chef at Aquavit. We had just got a 2nd 3-star. I just won Best Chef New York City.
And by the way, this was, how old were you?
I was 24 when I got the first 3 stars. But I was 33 when
not
we
bad,
got.
Not bad. No. You know, I was still scrubbing suds there.
But it was something else that I was really looking for. And there was 2 things that I always saw coming up. that made me think there was never women in the kitchen and there was never people of color, of any color. And I was like, once I became a chef, I'm like, well, if you have all these opportunities, you have to at some point recognize and carry a flag of change. What that change would be, I wasn't really sure, but you can't just have this position and this sort of platform and not carry, and that doesn't come part of your narrative and your cooking. So that was what kind of like how I ended in Harlem around 2003, not open Red Rooster, but just to learn about the community. Yeah, exactly.
Live. Mm-hmm. So you're in the giant melting pot. Harlem is, there's so many different boroughs.
Yeah, pockets.
And pockets of different cultures and peoples and food. And you've taken me to many places there and around Harlem, and you wanted me to try some chicken here. And you wanted me to try feijoada over here. And we had so much fun. And I think what you're doing here at Red Rooster, I mean, I actually did really good homework for a change.
I did.
I mean, Marcus is nervous. I got a lot of little stars in here.
Yeah.
So there's some things that really I think are really key that you and I talk about every day when you and I catch up. And two words, conviviality and hospitality.
Yeah.
And I think when you walk into Red Rooster, that's the feeling.
Yeah.
It's instant. But there's something right here that I want to read from the book if you guys haven't seen it yet. All kinds of elbows touch. Mailmen's and maids, churchgoers, choir girls, politicians, and their potential constituents, both black and white patrons, taste their drinks. That is a really powerful.
Yeah.
You're setting the tone for basically equality across the board.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, my first of all, being raised in Sweden, having not experienced poverty in Sweden, but my parents did, right? My grandparents were very poor. My father was a fisherman, but he became a geologist and had his own company. But in his core, he was a poor fisherman, right? He was the first to go to college and eventually got a doctorate. But that road of being connected to one place but evolving will always stick with me, right? And that my grandmother was a maid, but she was a cook. That was like the further she could go. She ate well when she was at work. But poverty was really what was around our... was it something that we really discussed. And cooking with my grandmother, she discussed the Second World War and what people have and don't have. So this idea of... as chefs, my mom was always saying to me, Marcus, why do you always cook for bankers? Like, why do you trust bankers' taste more than a nurse or a principal? You didn't grow up with bankers. You grew up with people working in a bank. This idea of bankers, what is that? Why do you trust that taste? And that was a hard thing for me to answer. I'm like, she actually right about that, you know?
Well, that's part of our training.
Yeah.
When we were younger, it was you cook in this style. It was shoot for the stars, right? What did Leah Chase say to you? Aim high?
Aim high. Always aim high.
Always aim high. So, and that's the same thing when we started in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal was to aim high. You're always aiming towards stars, working for the best. And at that time, in our mindset, that was the best.
That was the best. But the other thing that also happened was that after 9/11, New York was forever changed. And so was obviously the rest of the country and so many parts of the world. But you realized that fine dining as we knew it was changed forever. And coming back from that and rethinking, even if you can still serve great tasting menus and great food, your conversation changed. And for me, it meant let's take this as an opportunity to really move myself, pivot, change, search for something else, and start cooking for my neighbors. But once I moved up to Harlem, I realized I don't know this area. This area is magical. It's rich in history. It's rich on food. But it's on a different grid. Urban America lives on a completely different grid. But the food was delicious. There was Crab Mike that was chucking oysters. And I, you know, he wasn't on Twitter. He wasn't on any of that stuff. But he was there on the corner right outside the subway stop. There were people doing food trucks way before food trucks existed. So I was like, whoa, there's a different beat here. there is a different way to get to the good food. As a chef, I don't really, you know, we don't care if it's like tablecloths. If it's good, it's good.
So I've like, sent you to many a dive here.
Many, many, many good places here.
Which we're not going to share because we still like going.
But it was really about how can I learn about this community? And it took 7 years, Chris, between me and my wife and I moved to Harlem. It took us 7 years to have the courage, the good spot, to really actually open Red Rooster.
It's amazing. I got a couple questions here. Can I throw a couple in? Okay. Will you eventually open an Ethiopian fine dining restaurant?
That's a good question. I'm not ready. I'm not good enough. I'm learning about the culture, and obviously my wife is and her sisters are much better Ethiopian chefs than I am. I think one day, but I need to get better, you know? It's like, you know what that means. It's not just landing on the dish. It's also like understanding, you know, when you think about Ethiopian food, it's based on spirituality. It's based on two things. Spirituality, so it means that fasting is big, but also tribal. Well, I don't even speak Amharic. I don't even speak the main language. So landing, understanding spirituality and trying to understand tribal, you can't just land there because you're famous. You need to know your stuff. And my wife teach me a lot of that, but I'm not good enough yet. I'm just not.
That's being honest.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most difficult things is being true and honest to what you want to do and where your goals and aspirations are.
I mean, that's why Aquavit for me, takes the age away. That looks like incredible, but it wasn't hard for me. I truly grew up with that food. I knew how to, I had a clear vision of what nature and the closeness of nature of Swedish food and pickling, preserving, smoking, all of those different things, negative positive space. That's not hard. I'm completely fluent in Swedish. And I grew up with that. I did not grow up in Ethiopia.
Well, that kind of leads me into this over here, which is perfect timing. Birdland?
Yes.
So there's a whole section here in the book, for those of you who haven't opened it up yet, called Birdland. And Marcus's dedication to the research of understanding the what's and the how's for one simple thing, which some of us take it for granted because it's on a lot of street corners. But I think the key line in the book for me was, I could taste my fear.
Mm-hmm.
It tasted like chicken.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you say it, I had to nail fried chicken.
I had to.
And I think that to me is really, really, it's what a lot of people take for granted. I started to obsess. And when I obsess, I do three things. I research, I run, or bike. Mm-hmm. And I talk to everyone. I dive into archival stacks at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. I visited M&G Diner, Sylvia's Pan Pan. I even went to Kentucky Fried Chicken over and over again. Yeah. I mean, that simple thing of fried chicken, you can't take anything for granted.
No, you can't. I mean, I was actually with one of my friends the other night, and Mr. John Legend, he said to me, I remember in this whole research thing, he said, Marcus, you're fucking overthinking it. Just fry the damn bird. And I said, John, I can't do that. I can't do that. And he was like, because the book came out, so he's like, I remember when we were talking about the bird and the chicken and all that stuff. So but he knew how, you know, for me, we're half a block away from Sylvia's. We're another half a block away from Lennox Lounge. Well, Lennox Lounge has been there for 77 years and Sylvia's for 54. If we could have half as good run of them, we should just take that and be happy. But, so again, the fried chicken is, for me, where you can really set a mark as a chef, and it's an ode to understand the culture, but also you have to take a left turn, right? And so for my left turn was making sure we fried with dark meat only, bone in, skin on. And for a lot of people, white meat felt like a higher end version. I was like, no, there's more fat in the bone in the thigh, and skin on will protect the juiciness. And then as a chef, we can sort of deconstruct and understand temperature and understand how to get it crispy on the outside. Fried chicken has a sound. If you don't get that sound, somebody lied. And then the other thing, fried chicken, it also has then, if the juiciness doesn't come in after that, again, it's fried, it's chicken, but it's not what it's supposed to be. So these technicalities for us, that hat wasn't that hard to understand, but it was just the culture references and how to do it and at what temperature. And then, of course, then the spice blend, right? And then it was easy for me because I went to Berbere, the Ethiopian spice blend, and that gives us that left turn again that was a little bit different.
Which, that's our like tag team spice.
Yes, too. Absolutely. Chris actually cooked me the best version of, I've never seen a non-Ethiopian that naturally deal with Berbere. He cooked me, this is years ago, before even Berbere was on the map. He just charred carrots for me and just dusted it with Berbere. And it was so, you can swear or cannot swear?
I guess you can, I don't know. Is that a no? We're
good.
Getting a no-no
no,
from the corner.
No, wait, I wasn't even thinking about it. It was very good.
I'm going to throw in a couple more questions here.
It was good.
Actually, I think we got in trouble that night because you were supposed to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I know. We didn't get there.
Will you open a restaurant in the Bay Area?
I don't think so. I think the one thing you guys don't need is more restaurants. You have so many good restaurants.
I've been saying the same thing.
You have so many. It humbles you how good the restaurants are on every level, right? On the mom and pop, crazy good. On the high end, on the neighborhood. And now when you're adding, you know, of course, Oakland and all of that, but also now when the tech guys are actually getting real food into their, where they work, which means that they're actually going to have palates that are completely changed, that's, then they come back out and want to demand better food. So if you think about the whole area, I don't know an area that, you know, what is it, 4 or 5 million people, if you measure the whole.
Yeah, we don't have that much.
Not well, it's an amazing amount of food that is here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, per capita, we have tons.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go out every single day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, mm-hmm. and not hit them all.
And also, you have the other thing which I want, which I think is great for a city. People are opinionated. You guys care. You guys give a shit, which is good. Which is good. Which is good. Which is what, as a chef, that's what you want. And you think you know stuff, which is good. But that's good. No, but that, and that you do. But that comes with having a cultivation of understanding stuff.
Well, speaking of opinionated, you got a question here about
oh,
that.
Oh, good.
So what do you think the Yelp reviews for Red Rooster, why do you think the Yelp reviews for Red Rooster are so mixed?
I think that, I mean, yeah. Online is a great forum, right, for people that want to be in on a dialogue and want to level up and punch up, right, and be part of something that they have actually very little understanding of. And
hide behind anonymity.
Of course. But so...
Is the owner of Yelp here?
No, but I mean, good for them. I mean, it's what Rooster is. If we one would take a second to step back and... You know, New York is diverse by itself, but it's truly just diverse in the subway, right? That's truly diversity. And everything diversity you see in New York City people have worked hard to get there. And Rooster is one of those places where you actually diversity has to not have to be spelled out. So that what does that mean and why does that matter to this question? Well, it does because it has an... It's a restaurant where you can have cornbread and a beer and be done with for $9, and you can have lobster dinner for $90, right? There is no other restaurant in America where you can do that. Why that matters, that creates then a completely different landscape of wants, desire, relevance, and what food is good. What food is good. And so that, I've never created a menu like that, where I looked at the migration is really 50% of the menu. The other 50% is much harder for people to sort of understand, because part of it is my immigrant tale as a Swede, but also my immigrant tale as African, which Harlem has a lot. And then it has this El Barrio, which started as a Puerto Rican community, when today is as a Mexican community. And then you have the Jamaican and the Chinese thrown in there, and then you have the Jews and the Italians on top of that, right? And it's just shaky, 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 shaky.
Like the best cocktail.
So now, Yelp, I'm sorry, we operate on a higher level. It's not a Yelp opportunity to jump in. Winton is in the basement right now. Winton is not thinking about if Yelp is going to understand what he's playing right now. So when you operate on a different level, you actually have to. I never, ever, ever gone and read a Yelp review.
Me neither.
Because when you when you know your mission is, it's completely created with a completely different narrative, you need actually arrogance. And sometimes that arrogance is what gets you through the day. You need vanity, but you also need to understand your, at the same time, being humble, but also your purpose. Your purpose has nothing to do with the latest app or platform. So you just got to stick to your guns and do that, Yelp or not.
Bravo. What inspired your involvement with UNICEF?
I mean, it's easy. If you see the house that me and my sister come from, we come from a mud house that is basically the size of two tables in my restaurant, where now, until we went back there, 8 people lived in those 2 mud houses. So if you come from something like that and you've been helped, part of the reason why I'm in front of you is obviously because of the goodness of others. You know, we were adopted, yes, but before we were adopted, there was a nurse in the hospital that took us in. She had 4 kids herself. We survived tuberculosis. We were healthy, but we had nowhere to go. The nurse just said, I'm going to take the kids, and then set them up with an adoption center. And that was, that's how we got to Sweden. So if that's actually happened in real time in your life, you don't have to think twice about, you know, working with something like UNICEF, for example, or the Red Cross. Or, I mean, even as a chef, you know that. Like, chefs are, we're givers. We're, at the end of the day, givers, you know. Especially chefs that has had, you know, had a major change in their life. Just like you. You've been part of, you've had so many experiences that has informed you what your next decision is. And you talk about it. You're very vocal about, you know, dealing with hard issues that has nothing to do with restaurant. But like, Chris talks about mental health. What does that have to do with restaurant? But it's a very, very, very important topic. You know, obviously we all go through tough experiences when we open and close the restaurant, and why are we not working, and why is it working, and, you know, all of these very public things that we go through. But for you to stand out and talk about it, it takes a lot of courage, you know. And I think that's why something like UNICEF for me has been there for us, because it's very clear. I mean, I don't have to think about it.
Dude, look at this. Is,
yeah, man.
They keep
good.
Them coming. Look
opinionated.
At that.
I love that. I love that.
Okay, where am I going to go? Which,
yeah.
Which little sticky am
you
I going to go
man.
To?
You pick, man. This
next?
Is your show, man. This is great.
Okay, so let's talk about style in Harlem.
Yeah.
I've never met anyone who has style consistently, is always on point like you, Marcus.
And I'm the
when we're in Aspen, and it's fun.
I'm still the dullest guy in my community, in Harlem. I am. Oh, hands down.
I went shopping with Marcus in Aspen at one of the antique, really fun stores. I got to watch because I couldn't fit in anything.
Yeah.
But they brought out some of the coolest stuff for you. And every time, like I said, when I come to Harlem, I'm at the restaurant, everybody's dressed to the nines.
Yeah.
Every day, and it's beautiful to see. Like, everybody's so excited, beautifully dressed, gorgeous hats, suits, dresses. And it just seems fitting, Marcus, that
Well, dressing in poverty is very linked, right? Yep. Specifically for black people. Because as a black man, if you weren't dressed appropriately, you could get picked up by the cops. Actually, we would like to think that that has been removed, but not so much. And for women, the same thing. So that era is still the core of why people are being dressed up a certain way. They don't want to, it's nothing to do with the economy. It has to do with a lot of personal pride. And when I go out, you know, when they go out, they're like, we're out, we're celebrating tonight. So I think that is really a core of it. So when you go to the restaurant, I remember when we opened, it was in a time where people were talking, are you doing tablecloth restaurant or are you not tablecloth restaurant? Is it dressed down? Should I dress down or dress up? Again, once you acknowledge you're not part of the regular grid, it's not all bad. It's actually very liberating. And so when people were wearing Iron Maiden t-shirts and were upset downtown, people dressed up uptown. And, you know, when people talk about recession downtown, well, Harlem has always been a recession. So, you know, there's a different grid does not really impact happy, right? And style and personal pride. And I think I've learned a lot from that community about, you know what? You gotta walk your own walk here. And it's taught me a lot. And late last night we had Mr. Dapper Dan in the restaurant that really is the original founder of hip-hop style and original, you know, the recent way of companies like Sean John and why Louis Vuitton and Kanye is now dressed in certain ways is really because of Dapper Dan. And he can break it down. He has a whole chapter in the book where he breaks down style. We have a woman called, what I call Anna Wintour of Harlem, Lana Turner. She's also in the book. I mean, I'm a good runner for a Swede. I'm a really bad runner for an Ethiopian. So I'm a good runner. I'm a good dresser for the chef community. I'm a really bad dresser when you compare it to Harlem. I am.
Actually, that was my biggest concern today when I woke up this morning. Yeah. I said, I have no idea what I'm going to put
on. No, the ponies are right. The shoes are good. Your shoe game is hot. I like it.
Yeah. Did you guys see he's got the fried chicken sneaks on over here?
Yeah.
Pretty styling.
Yeah. For you guys.
So I have another question here from the audience. How is it cooking a steak dinner at the White House?
Oh, it's funny because I was emailing with Mario last night because Mario did a steak dinner.
Yes.
I was so happy for him. It's crazy. It's, you know, I'll tell you a funny story about it. I called my mom when I was at the White House. And I said, Mom, you can't believe where I'm at. I'm outside the Oval Office at the White House. You know, we're in a couple of hours. We're going to do the state dinner. This is what my mom says. Mom says this, Marcus, whatever you do, don't embarrass your father's name. If you can leave, try to walk out right now. Don't get in trouble. Do not get in trouble. I'm like, no, this is like a big moment. Thank you, Mom. That's like, that explains my upbringing in a nutshell. Don't embarrass your father's name. That's it. No, but it was crazy. I mean, even to do it was so much fun. But it's also about timing, right? You do four courses. They have to be done in 44 minutes. We broke. You always cook. You used the president's China. So we used the president's before, George Bush China. We broke some of it. I apologized. It was not intentionally. You know, but it was an amazing experience that I will never, never forget. And I was like, Mario, and he's like, it went great, and it was a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right. Cultural appropriation in fashion is often criticized, but in food it is usually accepted. Why do you think that is?
I mean, as Americans, we're a very young country when it comes to food, and we've learned food through France, through Europe. That's a big lie. Look at this audience. Look, great food. Look at the city. Great food is everywhere. Why is it that we pay? Chinese food should be cheap, and Japanese food should be expensive. Who came up with that lie? Up until 10 years ago, up until before Ferran, Italian olive oil was great. Spanish olive oil was horrible. Although, as chefs, we knew all olive oil was actually, most of it was actually Spanish olive oil labeled in Italy, right? So food really moves in certain ways. massive population like Italy or like France, like China or let's say India, massive immigration, let's say Mexico, or massive trading. Now, trading and tourism is very important to set perception. So we learned about great Italian food through magazine and tourism and French food. There was not a lot of written about Chinese food, and the Chinese labor was cheaper. Therefore, the Chinese food became cheap. Now, all of this has to do with culture. These are codes. Trust me, our own food, black food, same thing. Southern food should be cheap because it's in the poorer part of town. So all of these are codes that we now, basically since internet and maybe I would say around 2000, we start to unpack this and realize that, oh, Southern food does not have to be cheap. Chinese food doesn't have to be cheap. Japanese food doesn't have to be expensive. French food can be all types of food. You can be expensive. So we're just now, the last 15 years, try to unpack, unlearn all these different things that as chefs we kind of like, we stood in those kitchens and it wasn't really our questions to ask, but we kind of had those questions like, And that's why things like, well, I mean, Chris was one of the first to really start to do this, using parts of the animals that was just as good, of course, as the tenderloin, right? When you use pig ears, or when you use beef heart, or if you use, there were no such thing as bad cuts, right? And culture and coding and financial and racial and all of those things, it's all in there. It's coding. I'm telling you, I'm not paranoid. it's just coding. That's what it is. So culture has a lot to do with that. It's like saying like classical music is great and hip hop is crap, right? It's not. You can't. It's not. It's overcomplicated. It's more complex than that.
Everything has its place.
Yes.
Nothing is bad.
Absolutely.
And I think when you start looking at restaurants in different styles, yes. Every restaurant style has its place, whether it's high end or low end, financially, and none is worse than the other. They're just different styles.
And craftsmanship goes into, I mean, if you have a noodle dish that someone has made, pull the noodles, and they charge $8, and someone buys noodles and shaves a little, let's say the latest cheese on top of it, and that's a $38 dish, who lied? Somebody lied.
I love it. What are your favorite food memories from growing up in Sweden?
Oh, it's easy.
I think there's a Swedish mama here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think growing up with my, you know, we're imperfect people, all of us, and we live so long sort of like holding that down. But I grew up with a drunk uncle. He's a beautiful man, and it was wonderful. But, you know, he taught me everything about fishing. He took me out every morning early, and he had the spiked coffee, and you didn't have to wear like life vest or any of that stuff. But
so he was the fun.
That was the fun one. But fishing was everything, and you got mackerel, and you got 40 mackerels. You know, 10 went to your neighbors, 10 or 15 maybe you smoked, 5 or 10 you had for lunch, and then if you were lucky, he gave you 5 to 10 to sell to sell to the tourist, but. So eating mackerel around lunchtime, because you start at 5 o'clock in the morning, so lunch was like around 11, 30, 12, eating just pan-seared mackerel, and as a kid, you had to run outside because we had fresh horseradish and fresh chives. So we did mashed potatoes with fresh horseradish and chives. Seared mackerel, nothing tastes better than that. I mean, that's just the most simple way of cooking. And it's just so delicious. And when that horseradish stick your nose when you're a kid, it's just like all the faces you make. And that's just so delicious.
Oily fish.
Yeah, oily fish, exactly.
The tastiest fish.
I know.
Tastiest fish ever.
But it also teaches you about fish that mackerel is not a fish that you have to smoke or cure it that very day. It's not a fish like salmon that can hold for 3-4 days, right?
Doesn't like to hang on.
It doesn't hang out at all well. But it teaches you as a child, so when you're 8 years old, you know the difference between those things. How it should smell, when you poke it, if it doesn't come back out, all of those different things.
Awesome. So, historical culinary figures. There's a bunch in here.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to meet one of them.
Yeah.
Miss Edna Lewis.
Yeah.
Who definitely struck a big chord with me as a young cook. You talk about Leah Chase.
Yeah.
And I think these are a lot of chefs that people don't know.
Absolutely.
And one thing that I'll say is I think some of the best chefs in the world never, ever leave their home. They cook in their home for their families.
Absolutely.
But these two, in particular, these two women ran restaurants.
Yeah.
And I think they changed the way and the face of food, and they really influence you quite a bit.
No, absolutely. I mean, when I think about something that I know that Chris agrees with me, I think great food is a civil right. It's actually our civil right. Big journeys, like great food should not have a zip code, right? And how you fight that battle is very tricky. And I think when I think about someone like Leah Chase that actually had to break the law to serve an integrated restaurant, right? Because she opened a restaurant in the late 40s where she broke the law by serving white and black people in the same restaurant. To be a young black woman, to own your own business in the South. So restaurant means to restore. And she really restored your community. She fully understood that because a lot of the civil rights movements was held in her basement. When they needed a vote, they needed to go through Leah. And, you know, whether it's Katrina, whatever happened in New Orleans, Leah is still there. But when I look at the civil right, the whole idea about changing the footprint of dining in cities, and you start working and understanding how, what a great job the guys did of cutting off certain cities. They really made sure that good food and good commodities would not go into certain parts of town. So what we're doing now is to sort of break that, right? And I think it's sad, but it's the history and sort of the journey that we're in right now. You see great progress. You see in Harlem right now, we have 7 farmers market, which doesn't sound a lot maybe in this community. It doesn't, but it's out of a place where farmers market didn't exist. Not only do we have 7 farmers markets, we have farmers market that takes all types of payments and also have relevant ingredients that speaks to the community it serves and a different price points. Now, that matters. So I look at, you know, Leah's and her generation and Sylvia Woods, they set the table for me and for us to have a diverse restaurant. So we kind of got to create that so it's done to a much, you know, it's much more complex and layered today in a way. And I think that, I mean, she always talks to me about that. Marcus, aim high, keep pushing, you know. So I'm really inspired by Leah. Patrick Clark was a chef that came when I came to the city that was an incredible chef.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have to read a little business here. So this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking here with Marcus Samuelson, chef restaurateur and the author of The Red Rooster Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. I'm Chris Cosentino, chef owner of Coxcomb here in San Francisco. I'm your moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our YouTube channel, check out our website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, now the official stuff's over. Okay. Back to the real deal. I'm getting better at this.
Yeah, no, you're doing great.
I get to hit the hammer. I like the hammer. All right. We got all sorts of questions here, Marcus.
That's great. I love that.
You like the questions. It's good.
No, it's good questions.
All right. I'm going to line them all up here. Your thoughts and remembrance about your adventure in Ethiopia with your wife and Tony.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really Maya that traveling to Ethiopia with my wife, but also traveling with Tony, knowing that because it's on Tony Bourdain and CNN, a lot of people's going to see a different side. I really sat and thought about that for a long time. But it was an amazing journey, and I was so happy to be able to show that even if, you know, everything that we know about Africa, it's always something different, right? And it gets, if you think about the bad news about Africa versus the good stuff that happened, this was an opportunity to actually shift the narrative a little bit, to show another side about complex politics, about music, about nuanced food, you know. And I've said this for a long time. If you are a poor person in Ethiopia and maybe live off $2 a day, you're eating better than a portion of poverty in America. So think about that, because that poor person in Ethiopia, organic food, they eat that every day. Local, they don't have to think about. There's no, very little trans fat, and obviously there's no McDonald's or Burger King in their community trying to give them, you know, a bunch of bad calories. So we only had an hour there, but I think we're able to cover a lot for people to dive into, and then obviously through online or whatever things that spoke to you, you had a chance to sort of dive in deeper to really show the complexity of a country like Ethiopia. And it's obviously going through really rough times right now, but the spirituality and the majestic mystique around Ethiopia, I think we were able to tap into that. It was a lot of fun.
For sure. We had a big conversation about that when you came back, about meat.
Yeah.
The concept of meat in this country.
Yeah.
And toothsome versus
exactly.
Super tender.
I mean, we have the best teeth in the world, but all our meat has to be soft. No, it doesn't.
Isn't that a completely backwards thought process?
Yeah.
You know, and that was all about texture. We had this really in-depth conversation about texture. It was a really big learning curve.
And, you know, like in Ethiopia, the majority of the population are, most of the diets are vegetarian. So when you celebrate something, you celebrate through meat. And then depending on what tribe, you can have Tatars or chicken or beef, whatever it might be, or lamb. But it's meat. And it means that you eat lots of it, because that's the day, you know, everyone. When we had our wedding, the most important thing was that the village had a chance to eat meat. That's it.
What is your funniest behind the scenes chopped story? Mm. And does it involve Aaron Sanchez?
Yes. Yes. I mean, what I love about Chop now is Chop Juniors. I love it so much, because the kids there are, Chris, they know so much about the latest technology in the kitchen, because their first stop is not even TV. Their first stop is online. So they have never made ice cream before. They go straight to the ice cream machine. They go to the griddles they've never seen before. Like what? Whatever you think that traditional cooking in a pan, they go the opposite. So, I mean, the guts that they have, and they're not in fear of anything. So I do know that America, the food that's going to come out of that generation, it's going to be, I mean, Trump's going to hate it. That's all I can say. He's going to fucking hate it, because it's mixed, it's diverse, it's
all, you can't wall it in.
Oh my God, you can't block it. He's not going to be happy. That's all I'm going to say. But it's going to be delicious, and, you know, it's going to make America taste great again.
Do you enjoy your experience in television, and what has been your favorite and why?
I do enjoy the experience of being able to reach a completely different audience. I don't think it's a choice if you have a restaurant in Harlem. I think it's something you have to do. And I think media and food today, there are. You know, as chefs, it was something we didn't think about, we would work in media. But I do realize if you're going to put your restaurant in a destination and a neighbor at the same time, media is part of that journey. So... like anything, I look at it as prep. Like I look at it, I'm preparing for it. I enjoy it. And I enjoy it when I chopped. I love to do, because I always meet my friends. And not only the people that you see on camera, chopped is from the producers, from the people behind the camera, from the third assist. It's a family. It's like a restaurant. So chopped has probably been the experience I enjoyed the most, because it's the closest thing to a restaurant. People screw up all the time, and they're like, oh, he's part of the crew, and, you know, people forgive, versus being like, oh, you're out. Do you know what I mean? And I've never seen that type of La Familia environment in obviously we know it in restaurants, but I've never seen it on TV before. Part of that you guys see maybe, but a lot of it happens behind the scenes, and that's why I love Vivian and Lyndon and Michael and those guys that produce it, because they treat it like a restaurant crazy family. Which, that's the good juice, you know?
So, let's talk a little bit about media.
Mm-hmm.
And you did Top Chef Masters. Mm-hmm. You won.
Yeah.
Season 2?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yep.
And
in the beginning, yeah.
That was right before, this was right when you were, your brain was churning and you didn't know if it was going to be a chicken or a rooster, and the logo came and everything came right as you were walking on.
Yeah.
And that ended up being beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I think that both, what you and I have in common, we're both fighters, right? We did a lot of, we're as a chef, we're the opposite from a Yelp reviewer, right? What we do is public, and we ask you guys to participate and be engaged, and you guys are very honest. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't, right? And so at that moment when I did Top Chef, I just went through a big divorce, right? I just left Aquavit. And I went in there and put it all, that was my job at that time. At the same time, I was playing in State Dinner. Those were the two things.
I remember, we were talking about
that. Yeah, but it also gives you this liberty of like, I'm just gonna focus on the food. Where my other chef friends had to then think about the restaurants and all of that stuff, that TV, you know, you kind of like on and off. And it was a moment that I will never forget, because it was, I just put it all, I really put everything into the show that I had. And if I would be in the restaurant or one step in the show and one step in the restaurant, I don't think the outcome would have been the same. Because what I learned is that whatever you do, you need to be able to give everything. The way I entertain, the way I engage, the way I cook, I have to give everything. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
It's all or nothing.
Yeah. And Rooster is that. It's all on red. Or Top Chef Master was that. Maybe it was because I was out and felt like, all right, I got to get up, walk up here on 7 and the countdown, you know, and coming back. It was a lot of fun, too. You know,
it was fun.
Listening to Waxman and Susan and all those incredible chefs and listening to those stories. When we were done shooting for 10 hours, all we wanted to do was to have dinner with Jonathan Waxman and just press play and listen to an Alice Waters story or another story about so-and-so. And
or when he's talking to the vegetables in the market.
Yeah.
Talking to me?
Talking to
me. Talk to me, vegetables.
Absolutely.
Where is it? Okay. Is your presence in the kitchen important, or is it set to run like a machine? I have been to Red Rooster a couple of times and haven't seen you there.
It is, yeah. No, and it's. I don't think Red Rooster is a machine at all. It's a very humble endeavor that we're five head chefs, basically. This is woman CJ that if I don't hear her in the morning when I come in, she talks to everybody, she's on everybody. She used to be in the army, and this is her second career. And if she's not on everybody, she's the oldest but the youngest, right? She's not officially head chef, but she's treated like a head chef. She is the head chef. That morning shift is her. Then there's someone like Leo that is sort of the dad that everybody comes to and talks to. And then, so there's different characters, right? But everyone understands the purpose and the food, what we're going to do. And we're on top of each other. We're arguing all the time. All the time. And I'm happy that if they would not argue, I know there's a problem. And you know that feeling, right? If it's no pushback back and forth. So, I mean, we live in a Red Rooster kitchen or kitchens in general. The friction, we're not afraid of friction. I'm more afraid if we don't have friction. So it's about managing that friction to a crescendo that says, pop, it's 8 o'clock, this is what's happening, you're invited into that theater. So if it does work well, they should be able to do it without me. But of course, I'm part of the magic sauce, of course.
I think that brings up a really great point. I think, you know, we run a restaurant like a team. We could not do this by ourselves. No. We're not magic. When we go back to the restaurant, arms don't grow out of our back. We don't have eyes in the back of our head, and we can plate and cook at the same time. We have a crew of people that we're training to be the next. Mm. whether they're going to be the next chef of Marcus's next restaurant, or they move on and go be the chef of somebody else's. Mm-hmm. Our goal in life is to train the next generation, just like we were taught. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the biggest questions, you know, I get a lot as well, is, are you in the restaurant? Why aren't you here when I'm here? Mm-hmm. But we also have obligations.
Yeah.
You know, and we both have wives, we have kids, you know, there's things we have to do, and we do get a lot of people that are upset when we're not there, and it's, you know, it's okay if everybody else has a day off, but not of us.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's a catch-22 there. And, you know, the food, I would pretty much guarantee majority of the time, the food is better when we're not there, when we're not fiddle-fucking with everything they're doing.
Yeah.
Because, to be honest, we get in their way sometimes. Because when you got really great ones,
yeah,
they know your vision. It's like there's a chip in their head. It's like Marcus has put the chip, the little computer chip in their head, and they're rolling, and they know, and the recipes, and they're working. And trust me, you think his phone hasn't rung, like buzzed 20 times with pictures of, oh, chef, we want to do this, and we want... And it's all collaboration every day.
But I think also what we add is another layer of complexity and another layer of special, right? Because, when you go to a restaurant and you have VIPs phoned in, you have all that stuff, that's not like, special for me is like when the woman from the library comes to the Rooster that saved up. There is no expense account for her. This is her night out, maybe for 6 months. So we throw in an extra course for her, right? Yeah, it's easy when you know that sort of like, okay, Dinkinson on table, so-and-so. You have, let's say, a great musician over here. You have somebody that in the news, like you have somebody from Condé Nast over there. I get that, but you add something for the farmer and the farmer's nephew, and he's out on a first date, for example, like something like that. That's where the complexity is, what we add to. But it's also part of the theater that makes it special. And I think that's the challenge, right? But I don't want to stop. I mean, we are restaurant workers, and it's a very humble endeavor where we're going to have better days and not so good days, but we are givers at core, right? We're the ultimate 5 years old. It's like, look what I'm doing. Didn't that taste good? Didn't that taste good? But guess what? If we don't ask that question, that's it. You know, I don't want to come to work and not ask that question. Don't be excited about she's coming in, whoever that might be. So there are other chefs that can create magic in a completely different way, and bless them. I still, 30 years in, or 20, whatever it is, I can't. You know, that's my way of creating it.
We do at the restaurant, we do what's called Cook's Night. So if there's a cook that comes in. A lot of cooks can't afford to go out to a lot of the restaurants. There's a ticket being waved in the back corner over there, I just thought. Because I know there's only two questions here, so I'm sure there's more. We try to take care of the cooks. Mm-hmm. Cooks don't have the means to go out and eat all the time, just like the librarian.
Yeah.
They save up. They want to try different restaurants. So we play Crush 'em. Do you Crush 'em?
Absolutely.
It's really fun to give that multiple experience. And we also play another game. Just draw a table number out of a hat, and that table's called Soigné.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the mystery Soigné table. So some mystery table in there once a night on a busy Friday or Saturday gets a bunch of extra courses they don't even know is coming.
Yeah.
No, and that's a fun way to treat
but
people.
But it's also magic for that person.
Exactly. Like,
and I mean, it should be, once you come to a restaurant, it should be like, what the hell just happened?
I need to get Marcus that picture we have in the bathroom, don't I?
I mean, did that just happen? I want it to be a disbelief, right? Because people work so hard online, so for us it's like now you're offline, and you're here with us at this moment. And I want it to be leaning. I want it to be like, did that just happen? I can't put this even on Twitter. Like, it doesn't even work. No, stay right here. It happened. And that Soigné experience that you talk about, people will never forget that they got that, and they will never quite understand how and why did that just happen. Yeah. And that's the magic of going out. Otherwise, stay at home. It's a great option.
I think there's, you know, we all love having people take pictures at the restaurant and be a part of it, and I'm never going to say don't, but when you're there with people, enjoy your moment. Put that phone away. Be convivial with the people you're with. Share. Talk. I mean, this is what we talk about all the time. I mean, we know we're just as bad. We take pictures of things all the time, but
Evolved on that, right? I completely evolved. I remember the very first time at Aquavit when somebody put a laptop in the dining room. And I asked myself, I was that guy. I'm like, is that legal? Because I was like, what are you doing? We work so hard on creating a light. And my whole thing is like, I don't want women ever to have like hospital light on their makeup or any, you know. And I'm like, now you're coming with like a blue light coming from the computer. That's very offensive. It's like 8 o'clock. Is somebody that dressed up? And then my runner is like, I think he just did it. And I'm like, but can he do that? I'm like, I was arguing with my runner that was a legal move to do. I lost that argument. I remember the very first time somebody took a picture with a non-professional camera in my restaurant. I'm like, what's happening? What are you doing? And I lost that battle too. So it was about understanding and evolving that, okay, we are actually part of pop culture in a completely different way that is so much larger than I can comprehend at this very moment. But I still like the fact that I asked, because I couldn't fundamentally, coming from a Georges Blanc or coming from a very simple kitchen, to someone pulling out a phone and taking picture of it. The way it worked up until that point was I set up an appointment with a photographer. I knew exactly, I shot the food most of the time cold, because that's how you can control how the food should look like. And here, a steaming bra, somebody with a bad camera taking a picture and it's going to send it somewhere? What's going on?
That's every day.
Yes. But we have to evolve to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's never going to go away.
Yeah.
It's definitely the new norm.
But don't tell me you were comfortable with that when that happened the very first time.
Oh, no. No. Who's that with the camera?
Yeah.
What are they doing? What are they taking pictures of?
Yeah.
It's the nature of what it is now, and it's never going to go away. All right. So I got some more for you. If I can read that one. Oh, what's the best thing you've ever eaten on Chopped? That can be scary.
It's the little thing. I remember when this cook, there's two women that I'm going to go back to. This one young woman, I forgot her name, but she diced cucumber very different. She salted them, which I understood. But then she tossed them with a little bit of she did like this whole Japanese treatment on it, right? But the way she cut the cucumber, very different shape. And obviously the knife technique she used made sure that they tasted completely different. And it was such a smart move. And she was maybe 22 years old. I'm like, and she was not Japanese, right? I'm like, what's happening? What's happening?
Good catch.
Yeah,
good
I know. But like that was for me, it wasn't the biggest swing. It wasn't the biggest, but just understanding those. And it's all umami and it's all oversalted, but the cucumber, once it comes in your mouth, the water sort of cleanses it up. And I'm like, I've had that in Japan, not that cut, but I've had it with just a slight dip of soy cured in miso. And here's this 22-year-old doing this, never even been to Japan. And I just thought, to have the audacity to do that, that was unbelievable to me.
I think that's what's amazing about food now, is the availability of education. Unlike what we didn't have. We had books with no pictures. Thank God for Jacques Pepin when he did La Technique, because...
Well, thank God for Charlie Trotter when he really changed the game.
When he changed the game with all the cookbooks. There's access that was never there before.
So I'm very torn about that, right? I lost a bet. You're looking at a person that went to Japan for fuga dinner for Blowfish at 19 years old. And I did it because my dad gave me an article and said, read this, you like food. There's a fish, if chef doesn't treat it right, you can die from it. And I read this article, like, holy shit. And then I said, And I said to him, like, I want to save up and I want to go. Now, if we would have had internet, I would have gone online and searched that. I don't think I would have gone to Japan.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
It's so almost made it too easy.
Yeah, and I think that teaching, you can learn, but nothing beats do. right? And yeah, you can experience it, but you got to kind of, and I was very happy that I didn't have internet. And I did go to Japan. It took me a year to save up the money to go, but it wasn't just fugu I learned that day, that trip, right? I learned about, you know, the sushi is actually not a fish dish, it's actually a rice dish. I learned about, oh, what the temperature of that should be, and all these things that you can't learn by, you know, you got to be there in the moment, right?
Yeah, for sure. All right. I'm from New York. I've been to Aquavit and Red Rooster many times. What's next and why?
Well, there's many things. But I think for me, I have this small ambition of putting, if you look in New York, especially in East Harlem and the Bronx, if you look at, I would love to put on the rooftops of all the projects, I would love to put green gardens. And it would change the whole city in so many ways. When you fly in, you don't try to avoid the project anymore. There would be green. They would speak to you and they would say, come to us. And I mean, there also would be fascinating, aspirational as you look up, and we know what downtown's going to do. They're going to put more skyscrapers up, and there's no rooftops on those skyscrapers. But it will also be very aspirational to change. And think about the foot traffic that would change, that people have to go up to the rooftop and actually take care of their gardens. I think that restaurant being situated in the community like Harlem has completely, for me, changed how I think about what's good food and what's important. But I also know that that is the idea. If we don't do that and have a large conversation about it, it's not going to happen. You like to think change happens easily. It doesn't. It's very uncomfortable. But I think that that would be a great extension of the work and the purpose that we're doing right now.
That's awesome. All right, I got a couple more here. We got 3 minutes. I'm going to try to get them all in. As a recognizable chef, do you feel that these are issues, culinary or otherwise, that you should address through your food?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a way of addressing it. I do recognize that we have a platform where our food festival in Harlem reaches like 12,000 people come up to have a food festival in Harlem now. That was not on the table before. That's obviously a step in that direction. Trying to do green gardens on rooftops is that. But I think that's that doesn't make me different than most of the chefs that we know. We all address the other stuff that we care about, right, Chris? Yeah. Through our work, you know? So I don't think I'm different than that. Obviously, the luxury of being a black man allows me to see the filter this way through our own experiences. You've had your experiences. Doesn't mean you're insensitive to what I'm talking about, but you have your experience that you want to champion. And then through your chef friends, you get us involved in something that I may or may not be that knowledgeable about because it was not an experience that I had maybe, you know?
Okay, I'm having a difficult time reading.
I love that, and he's got the nice glasses too. I love those glasses. Those are nice.
Thank you. They're brand new. I like them.
Yeah.
The best part about them is they're transitional or progressive. Sorry. What motivates you to keep going every day?
No, I think that cooking. Well, this is just the beginning. I feel like I'm more curious today than I was when I started. And anytime you're like in the middle or beginning of your career, you can be more excited. That's a good thing. I mean, I think I'm like putting the green gardens on the rooftop. Yeah, that's a big idea that we will need a lot of help with, and that keeps me going.
Aim high.
Aim high, exactly. Aim high. Nice. I like that. Nice. That's good. Good.
What person in past or present day would you want to cook for? That's a great one.
Well, I got to put a couple in there. I brought him up before, but I miss someone like Charlie Trotter because he was one of the first people that really helped me out in this country, and he was very complex and layered. But I really, to do what he did in Chicago and communicate that to the world, that Americans can do it too. And we talked a lot about Miles Davis. We talked about food too, but he took me to places like Arun. He introduced me to people like Ferran Adrià. And Nelson Mandela on top of that would be very nice.
Okay, we've got 1 minute, but I think we have enough time to get all these questions done. So
right.
I gotta do my...
You're doing great, by the way.
I'll have to do my closing moderation after. Yeah. But I want to get all these questions in. So how do you recognize restaurant... We'll try that again. How do we recognize restaurant reviewers? Can you get a couple more R's in that first sentence for me?
Yeah, no.
And what do you value most in a review? I ask as a restaurant reviewer who remains anonymous. Really?
I think a great review, I do think a great review, the thing that you're struggling with your team, a great reviewer can actually pinpoint that, right? And it comes out. And then every now and then, you can get the benefit of the doubt. When I got my first 3-star review from Ruth Reichel, she actually, I feel like she reviewed the intent of what we tried to do, even though they were definitely not perfect, but she gave me the benefit of the doubt. When we got our second 3-star, we were much more established, but you kind of like, we felt like we earned, we you know, it's a different way of cooking for you. And I think that what a great review can really, in an articulate way, pinpoint where you're struggling with and want to do better and ambition. And that's all it is. It's pinpointing a value proposition. It pinpoints something. And sometimes why they hurt so much is because you worked so hard at that very issue. And you know you haven't fixed it.
It can feel very personal.
It feels, oh my God.
Because that's what we do.
That's
we put everything
we
have into it every day.
Yeah. So it doesn't get easier, but I do think a great review can really be something to hold up and be like, guys, we need collectively, only us, 20 of us, or 30, whatever it is in your team, we can do this. Of course, you have the fear and the pride and all of those different things, but once you put that aside, and people come anyway, because they want to give you a chance to, you know, see, hey, did he respond to that? And it so I think it's an exciting, reviewers and chefs will never be on the same side, nor should they, right? It's just part of the theater.
All right, let's see. What was the biggest adversity you've faced in your career, and how did you overcome it, carry on to your success?
Well, I mean, that's many. I think that in the beginning, it was always being the only one, always be the only black person and being denied many jobs because of it. But it also made you more precise. But then being legal in this country. That was a big deal. I mean, I'm an immigrant, and then I remember specifically, this book starts when I get robbed in New York City, and I don't think about the cash I have in my pocket. I think about to not take my legal papers. Like, I don't even believe in legal, illegal. I wasn't doing an illegal act. I was waiting for my legal papers. And that guy that robbed me, he had no idea that, listen, you can't take my papers. This is my shit. This is why I work for this. You can take my cash, but you can't have my papers, right? So to overcome that, without that, I wouldn't be here. So I think that sometimes why are this moment we're in right now is so personal to me because, Trump is very racist, of course, because that's how he was raised. And then he also talks about immigration in a way like, it's so anti-American to me, and I moved here because of diversity, because of these things. So these very things that I believed in and better on are now at this very moment being challenged to me. So it's very personal, but we will overcome.
So what you're telling me is he doesn't come to Red Rooster.
No, we lied. It's not. It's not going to happen. I know it's not going to. Dude, he doesn't even go uptown. And that's a good thing.
Okay. Now that you're a parent, do you worry about how behind U.S. school food is in health? Celebrity status can have an impact and help change it.
Yeah, it's bad. No, it's bad because you know that. and
it's horrible.
It's bad. It's gotten a lot of better, but it's not even close. My issue with this is that we know we can fix it. You know, this is actually one of these things that you actually can fix. Certain stuff we might not know how we're going to fix it. But this is actionable, a fixable idea. I grew up in a country where I was very fortunate to have a good cooked meal, every day at 12 o'clock, between 12 and 1:30, whatever, you could vary a little bit, you had a good meal. You had rye bread, you had a fish or meat or a salad, and, you know, maybe at the time we didn't think it was the coolest meal, but it was a good meal, right? Today in Sweden, you email in if you have dietary or religious issue, and you get a very, you know, on Sunday, your parents get this menu back and say, hey, on Wednesday, we have this, what we changing the menu for. So it's, I know Sweden is like Connecticut, it's a small state, but that this is not a hard idea to fix. It's really where we want to deploy our resources for, you know? So I worry about it. But also see great examples of, just a couple of blocks away from where me and my wife live in East Harlem, Edible Schoolyard has this amazing program. So there, where public and private work together, you see some of the best things too. So I feel slightly optimistic.
I have three more, and Marcus is going to sign some books. So have you ever had a single moment in your career when you knew you made it?
I don't know if you can as a chef. I think that you constantly are humbled by the challenge at hand, whether it's fixing the sink or getting the dishwasher to become a prep cook, or whether it's why is my restaurant not full enough, or why is it over? Like, I think it's a very humble trade. And for me, making it is not a bus stop, right? It's not like, oh, we're here now. No, it's an evolution that it's very rewarding, you know? I dig it more today than I did when I started. You know, so I don't know if I want to, I don't even know what that term actually means fully. Like, I never felt like, yeah, you know
this
what
is,
I mean?
This is a very,
yeah,
very common conversation.
Yeah.
And it's an obsession. We're obsessed with what we do.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, use that word passion.
Yeah.
But passion is, I don't think, the right word. I think obsession is the right word.
It's
We're obsessed with what we do. We're obsessed with making people smile. We're obsessed with making it taste better, getting the best product, giving the best experience. And I think that's why
I've never heard flipped like that, but that's a very smart analysis. Yeah, passion, I agree with you. Passion does not cover all of it, because there's also a very fearful, sick movement going on at the same time. So it's very contradicting in many ways. And very cerebral, too.
Okay, so
we just got cut. We just got chopped, right?
I get to hit the mallet again.
I just did it.
Our thanks to Marcus Samuelson, chef restaurateur and the author of Red Rooster Cookbook. Hey.
Also, can I just say this? Thank you guys for always supporting. I don't take that for granted. And thank you so much to Tatiana and Chris for hosting us here. I smile when I come to San Francisco, because I know I'm going to run into my chef friends, and it's very special for me to see Chris' very personal endeavor and how you're now going to evolve it, taking it to Napa. Can we talk about Napa? And taking it to Napa, and hopefully out of state tune. So it's, you know, we can't do this without your support, so please continue to support it. We appreciate it. Thank you. Dung. Yes. Did you see the smile? That's like, I'm not doing it right. Your grandpa would have approved.